In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Friday, September 27th, 2013, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. We kick off the Federal News Countdown, and this is a rather historic Federal News Countdown. I've been doing this show now for going on 4 years, and today is the last time that the Federal News Countdown will air in the 3 o'clock hour on In Depth with Francis Rose. Moving to 4 o'clock next Friday, so if you love the Countdown show, which I hope you do, I hope that you are here at 4 o'clock next Friday afternoon. The experts choosing the stories on the Federal News Countdown this week, Molly O'Neill from CGI Federal. It's great to see you, as always, my friend. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And John Kaminsky, the IBM Center for the Business of Government. Thank you for coming in.
And thanks a lot for the invite.
Happy to do it, as always. And you have each chosen terrific stories on the Countdown. And I must say, given where we are and what all we have to cover, neither of you went for the stereotypical things that you would expect somebody to choose. You guys chose terrific selections, and we're going to start where we always do with
number three.
Molly, your choice for the third most important federal news story of the week is my colleague Jared Serbu's story titled NIST Puts Finishing Touches on Critical Infrastructure Cyber Framework. One thing I noticed in Jared's story, and I wonder if this was something that you thought was important about this, is I'm still not seeing exactly what the carrot and stick will be for the private sector people that this framework is intended to help.
Yeah, and I think that's an important part of the story, right? I think the intention for the framework is fantastic because I think all of us who have worked in government, especially on the IT side, sort of understand how important security is and the connection to the private sector around infrastructure. And with the cybersecurity legislation where it is, but we've got the cybersecurity OMB memo that said, you know, we want to encourage you to do it. The question is, how are we going to take whatever framework and really put the carrot in the stick for people to use it? And I think what this article talks about is, you know, we don't want this to be a book on a shelf from a CIO or CISO's perspective, a chief security officer. So how do we incentivize those providers of critical infrastructure to actually take this really seriously, to understand their security posture, to implement the right tools out there so that they can make sure that they've done everything they can to protect that? I think one of the ways, I mean, it's not in the story here, and I'm hoping we'll get that way, is we need to start to tell the stories on really what can happen a little bit more publicly than we only usually tell them when we suppose something happens in the news.
The outside the beltway cyber people that I talk to say that the biggest area of vulnerability across the country right now is the private sector critical infrastructure. Agencies have gotten better. Major companies, private sector companies have gotten better, maybe mainly because they understand the intellectual property risks that they're at if they didn't develop more robust defenses. And it's this critical infrastructure sector that really is lagging behind. Is that a fair assessment in your view?
Well, I think the issue is really what you said. What's the carrot and the stick here, right? And so lacking any kind of requirement out there or real salesmanship of what could happen, and at least putting it in a business, you put it in a perspective what could happen to the country, right? Economically, but you put it in perspective what could happen to people, mm-hmm. right? And then what happens to the company? You got to think about all of those things in order to make people aware of what could happen. And I think people need to start putting pieces of the puzzle together a little bit. I know I'm a little bit of a techno geek, and so I look for interesting things, and I read stories about, you know, the technology. If you read the stories about people being able to drive our cars now, right, because mm-hmm. they've gotten so high-tech, so there's the security around those kinds of things. We need to apply those into what could happen from a critical infrastructure perspective.
Molly O'Neill's third most important federal news story of the week is my colleague Jared Serbu's story on federalnewsradio.com, headline, NIST Puts Finishing Touches on Critical Infrastructure Cyber Framework. John Kaminsky, your selection for the third most important story of the week is Jason Miller's story on federalnewsradio.com. OMB gives agencies more control over financial management systems, and this fits with what the administration has been saying all along about how they want to make it easier for agencies to do their jobs by removing obstacles, by removing things, essentially items from checklists that they have to check off. And the number that jumped out at me was Jason writes, OMB's reduced the number of requirements from more than 500 to about 60 that focus on outcome or output. That's a huge chunk of things that you don't have to abide by anymore.
Well, it's not that you don't have to abide by them, but there's a different way of approaching them.
Okay.
20 years ago, when Vice President Gore and President Clinton were on the South Lawn, they had these forklifts of regulations. And some of these things grew back over the years. And this was an instance where OMB stepped back, and they're doing it in other areas, like grants and other areas as well. And in this instance, they're looking at the requirements that govern the purchase and use of financial management systems. And so this is something that's been evolving, is how do we get financial management systems in the federal government to produce audited financial data? And it started with the Joint Financial Management Improvement Program probably 30 years ago, maybe even longer. And then that evolved a few years ago into the Federal Systems Integration Office. And what those two offices have done is developed a series of technical standards or requirements. So this is what things need to look like. And that kept on growing and growing and growing. And then agencies felt like they were in a straitjacket. And so what Sylvia Burwell has done and the OMB staff has said, let's shift from how do you get good financial systems to what a good financial system should look like, and you can figure out the how. And that's why the 550 or so requirements have gone away, but there's 60 other things of saying this is what it should look like. How you get there is up to you, but this is what it needs to look like in the end.
So that means a lot more autonomy for the agencies to determine this, does it?
It's more flexibility to figure out which system, because you have a one-size-fits-all set of requirements, and you apply it on a small agency that only has maybe three or four people sometimes, and the Defense Department, which has, you know, three some point something million people in it. And you can't just use the same one-size-fits-all requirements. And so this allows for, I think, more rational approaches. But the more important thing is it winds up saving money, because you don't wind up doing things that don't make sense in your agency's context.
If this approach is successful in financial management systems, where would you expect to see them go in the future with something like
this? There's approaches, I think, underway currently in, like, grants management, which is another huge area. Mm-hmm. Another might be, for example, federal acquisition regulations. So there are a series of different kinds of administrative systems where this conceptual approach could well work. Now, Molly, you had this experience with these kinds of systems when you were in government.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the good news is there's flexibility. The bad news is there's flexibility. and I say that, you know, a little bit flippant, because I think agencies need the flexibility as long as they know what the outcomes are. Yeah. But there's also, to me, a fear that with that flexibility becomes even more costly systems. So because if you don't control and you don't feel like you're doing things, so I think the key here is what can you do to get a clean audit, right, is number one. And secondly, is how do you keep that flexibility without having it uncontrolled?
Yeah. John Kaminsky's third most important federal news story of the week on this week's Federal News Countdown is from federalnewsradio.com. OMB gives agencies more control over financial management systems. You can read it and all of our stories on this week's Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back on the Federal News Countdown, the second most important federal news stories of the week is selected by my experts Molly O'Neill and John Kaminsky when we come back.
Zell, host of Power of Attorney Radio, every Saturday here on 1500 AM at 10 AM. Please join me this week for my special guest, Brad Russell, founder and president of the Washington West Film Festival, which will take place on October the 23rd to the 27th here in Reston, Virginia. Power of Attorney is brought to you by Odin Feldman and Pittleman. For more information about the law firm, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
Security. It's more than a headline in today's newspaper. It's your job to securely manage the thousands of printed pages your organization produces each year. That's why GovConnection is your premier provider for HP end-to-end print technology solutions. HP devices are future-proof for security and comply with regulatory mandates. Users can print and digitize documents without compromising safeguards. Learn more and take advantage of end-of-year volume discounts at govconnection.com/HP.
Life is filled with uncertainty, military life especially. AFMA can help you breathe easy through it all. Since 1879, AFMA has helped military families with low-cost military life insurance and the best survivor assistance. We're experts at helping you manage the complexities of military life and securing your family's financial well-being. Call 1-877-398-2263 today or go to AAFMAA.com to see how we can help you.
Attention civilian employees of the intelligence community and the Departments of Defense and State. You could be eligible for affordable term life insurance from GEBA, the Government Employees Benefit Association, with coverage issued by Prudential. Learn more about this important benefit for government employees at GEBA.com/term life. That's GEBA.com/term life. Group term life coverage for GEBA is issued by the Prudential Insurance Company of America, 751 Broad Street, Newark, New Jersey, 07102. Contract series 83500.
The Cybersecurity Report is brought to you by University of Maryland University College.
What is DHS's role in cybersecurity? DHS uses intrusion detection tools to monitor .gov network traffic for malicious activity and uses the resulting data, they say, to address cyber vulnerabilities. In addition, DHS issues bulletins and alerts to provide information on potential cyber threats. Last year, DHS issued more than 5,000 alerts and advisories. I'm G.J. Green.
Secure your future with a bachelor's or master's degree in cybersecurity, available entirely online from University of Maryland University College. Their programs have been specially developed by experts from government and private industry, so you'll get the real-world skills you need for your career. Plus, UMUC is designated as a National Center of Academic Excellence in Information Assurance Education by NSA and DHS. University of Maryland University College. Call 800-888-UMUC or visit umuc.edu/cybersecurity.
Will Congress agree on a budget bill the president can sign? I'm Emily Kopp. Whatever happens this weekend, rest assured, you'll have all the news you need to know on Monday's Federal Drive. And we'll also meet a federal researcher drafting a Richter scale for wildfires. We've got lots more, too, starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for the latest federal news, check out federalnewsradio.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week with the most important federal news stories as selected by Molly O'Neill and John Kamensky. And we are up two on the countdown.
Number two.
John Kamensky, your second most important story of the week is Charlie Clark's story from GovExec. The headline is Travel and Conference Cutbacks Are Harming Innovation, survey finds. And I read through this survey, and it's not... even close. I mean, the numbers are all in the 70s and 80s, demonstrating that federal employees believe that their inability to mix with each other and exchange ideas is really harming the federal government, not just operationally, but financially, too,
yeah,
John.
Yeah. And I have talked to an agency head that says, oh, yes, I've cut travel by 72%. And, you know, not like that's necessarily a good thing
right.
to do. But this is having an impact on the workforce. It's not just cost cutbacks or sequester stuff. In the survey, it said 72% of agency respondents reported having traveled to fewer events this year than the previous year. But also 72% of participants thought that collaboration between government and industry is being negatively affected. Face-to-face is really important. Collaboration and working together creates trust and stuff. And you can't do that through email or video conference calls, et cetera. You sort of need to get out and mingle. And this isn't happening this year. The question then becomes, is this become a new way of doing business? Because the sequester and the fiscal impact is stretched out over a 10-year period.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is that the agencies are saying that they're beginning to cope with this by increasing participation in webinars, reading the publications as opposed to going to meetings, and reviewing websites. So there are alternative ways, but they're kind of second best at being able to do this.
The part of this that I thought was the most
potentially challenging for the government, Molly, is something that Charlie pointed out in this story. The survey analysts write, 77% of agency respondents agree that industry will need to become more creative in informing and educating government customers. 91% of industry respondents agree. That, to me, my takeaway is more overhead, as you and your colleagues in the government or in the industry side have to develop ways to educate people. That doesn't come free. You know, you have to develop ways to inform them about what their possibilities are for the things that they're doing and the services you can offer them.
Yeah, and I think sometimes those aren't, you know, when you're on a long-term contract, right? Some of that's really not built into it. Mm-hmm. So how do you figure, and that's why I think why you're saying you got to use your own overhead and whatnot and find resources that may not have been planned for to make that happen.
Yep.
And so I do agree with you. And I also think, I was just going to point out something that John was saying. I think that, you know, it's unfortunate that whenever there's like cuts in budgets, they're just sort of made and they say travel because maybe a controversy went out there or you know, conferences because, you know, something happened in the news last year and there was a couple agencies. And I wish that when we had these mandates in government, we could say, let's look at this from a strategic standpoint. You know, let's look at where we need to travel. Let's look at the kind of conferences we go based on where we are. Let's really do this because I think what happens is just no, right? Or we're cutting at this. And that's the problem, right? Right, John?
Yeah.
I mean,
well,
there's no strategy.
One is the dealing with interacting with industry, but the other is scientists interacting with each other.
Exactly.
And that is crucial for scientists to get together and share their findings and learn from each other, not only within the U.S., but also internationally.
Well, I don't think that's limited just to scientists. I mean, that's true in your old field, Molly, of being a chief information officer, exchanging ideas. It's true in human resources. It's true in management. It's true in all aspects of not just government operations, but just enterprise operations as a whole. That face-to-face exchange time. I mean, I remember sitting at a table with you at ELC, Molly, a couple of years ago, and a colleague of yours who's still in the federal government, and that was serious business going on that you let me listen in on and hear what that was solutions conversation. It was not talking about golf. And so that face-to-face interaction is valuable, it seems to me, all across the sphere.
And if you think about it, I mean, think of these government agencies aren't just here in Washington, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I was at EPA for a while. I think everyone knows that here in the room anyways. But that was a headquarters office, right? Regional offices, field offices. And every once in a while, for everyone to be on the same page, as John said, you have to look each other in the eye. And I'm a big proponent for alternative ways to collaborate, right? But at the same point, you can't understand policy or roll up your sleeves to do scientific research and then also have industry involved in different aspects as well. You have to have some of that face-to-face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there a balance that we can see on the landscape somewhere, or is this something that you think is subject to swinging back and forth and right now swinging more toward the not happening area just because of the nature of the debate on Capitol Hill?
Well, I am finding myself more engaged in use of webinars and video conferences than I have in previous years. And part of that is the maturation of the technology, but part of it is being driven by people not being able to actually do any travel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that's true. And I guess the hard part is we can do webinars. Mm-hmm. But what's nice about a conference that is focused on something real, right, a good conference is you have the ability to ask the questions and to interact and network after, right? So you can have the follow-up to say, you know what, I really liked what you heard. That's a little bit harder. And then what that means is government officials or government employees need to say, listen, I did learn something, and I got to make a point that when I got to reach out to that person because they had a really good idea I want to talk to. And that means they don't – usually you spend the time doing that because you blocked out that amount of time. It means concerted effort to say, I need to follow up. And that is not the mentality all the time.
It requires a much more disciplined approach to be able to do this electronically than just informally.
And much more proactive, too, I would think.
Yeah.
You know, if you're doing what Molly's talking about, where you've got to have a really strategic to-do list after something like this. John Kaminsky's second most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec. The headline is Travel and Conference Cutbacks Harming Innovation Survey Finds. And you can read it and all of our countdown stories on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We've got links to them all there, including the second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Molly O'Neill. That's next on the Federal News Countdown.
At BAE Systems, we realize it's critical that our armed forces can get the job done, even when budgets are tight. That's why our engineers created the technology to transform an unguided munition into a precision laser-guided rocket, the perfect low-cost surgical strike solution. Knowing our work makes a difference inspires us every day, so we'll be there on the next front. That's BAE Systems. That's inspired work. Learn more at baesystems.com/nextfront.
Uber conferences is free. You basically decide who you want in the phone call, and you set up the time for the phone call. Like, I want to make a conference call at 2 o'clock tomorrow. And you could put all these people in a group, so you could easily just add the group. And then what happens, at the time of the conference call, Uber call calls everybody, and it also sends them an email, and they're in the conference.
Huh. Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
The Guiding You Home Safely Report, provided and paid for by the National Air Traffic Controllers Association.
Congress recently returned to work with a crowded agenda. Lawmakers tackled three major tasks related to the federal budget: set annual agency funding for the new fiscal year that kicks off October 1st, come up with an alternative to the automatic spending constraints known as sequestration, which are set to take an even bigger bite from federal spending in 2014, and negotiate a raise to the borrowing limit before the government defaults on its obligations.
Hi, I'm Trish Gilbert, Executive Vice President of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. I've been an air traffic controller for more than 21 years. I chose this career because it gave me the chance to do something very important. Air traffic controllers like me take great pride in working hard to ensure the safety of 70,000 flights a day in U.S. airspace. We strive to reach the highest level of professionalism. So on your next flight, sit back and relax. We'll guide you home safely. Visit NATCA.org.
Achieve continuous monitoring through the security-connected framework from McAfee. Built on more than two decades of proven security practices, the security-connected approach helps agencies improve security posture, optimize security for greater cost effectiveness, and align security strategically with mission objectives. Visit futureagency.com to learn more. That's futureagency.com. For each unique visitor to futureagency.com, $1 will be donated to the Wounded Warrior Project.
Maintain, don't gain. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Nicholas Garlow with HHS HealthBeat. Losing weight is hard. Keeping yourself from gaining weight may not be easy, but at least it's not as hard as losing it. With that in mind, researchers at Duke University have been looking at what they call the maintain, don't gain approach. Researcher Gary Bennett checked data on 97 black women in an intervention group in which each woman was in a program that included personalized goals for diet and physical activity. He compared them with another 97 who got basically weight loss counseling.
62% of women in our intervention group completed the intervention with weights at or below their starting weight, compared to only 45% of women in our usual care group.
The study in the journal JAMA Internal Medicine was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Nicholas Garlow.
For over a century, Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington has served the youth in our nation's capital. The club's new STEAM initiative uses the arts to teach science, technology, engineering, and math. Today, more than ever, we need your support of STEAM. It will encourage our youth to think rather than memorize, create rather than copy, and to be resourceful rather than reserved. So visit boysandgirlsclubs.org. Send a dollar or more as an investment to help us help our kids pick up STEAM. Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington, great futures start here.
This message is brought to you by GEICO and Federal News Radio.
Now your Federal News Radio cybersecurity update, afternoons at 30 minutes past the hour. Federal agencies have been steadily increasing their use of encryption technology to secure data. That requires management of keys, the pieces of software that encrypt and decrypt files. The National Institute of Standards and Technology will hold a workshop next spring to help refine its guidance on how to use and manage crypto keys. The workshop will take place March 4th and 5th. NIST IT Lab officials want to polish a new draft of Special Publication 800-152 titled A Profile for U.S. Federal Cryptographic Key Management. They say the draft will be available for comment before the workshop. You get your cybersecurity update afternoons at 30 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and Federal News Radio.com.
We're back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by John Kaminsky of the IBM Center for the Business of Government and Molly O'Neill of CGI Federal. And Molly, your second most important story is from Josh Hicks of the Washington Post. What is the cost of a government shutdown? And this is a very well-reported story that Josh did, and there are some really good details in here. But my takeaway from this was, it depends, and the old Mike Causey line. And I wonder if you see anything more solid in this than I did.
I'm not sure I saw anything more solid. I liked some of the quotes, which is why I chose it. And John and I talked about this right before we came on, and I loved it. It's like moving. It costs you when you pack, and it costs you when you're unpacked. And I think the reason that I like it is because we talk about the shutdown and what the cost is going to be, or the savings might be, right? However you want to look at it, if there is a government shutdown. But all of what leads up to it, you know, if you think outside of what's going on the Hill in the debate, what the agencies are doing to plan for things or not plan, it's the end of a year this year, right? End of the fiscal year. It's so how much time and effort is actually spent trying to figure out what you won't be able to do?
Mm-hmm.
And so it sort of distracts from sort of the mission of an agency. It costs money when you're distracted. So and then when you come out of this, there's the whole ramp up. So I like the story because it begins to shape a number. But more importantly, I like the story because it says, regardless of what that number, because it is what it is, mm-hmm. right? And we can try and put brackets around it. The reality is, it's a huge disruption, and it is a cost.
Well, what I found interesting is that, you know, this is a story about shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
The follow-on story is, even if they have a congressional or a continuing resolution, there's a cost for doing business that way. Last year, Phil Joyce from the University of Maryland did a study for us, and he went back and looked at a lot of the GAO reports and stuff. He says, you know, agencies can't do a year-long contract. When they're under a continuing resolution, they have to do a shorter term. So sometimes they do weekly contracts. So they do 52 contracts instead of one with an entity, or grants or something. And so the costs aren't just shutdown. There are other things that will happen, that we know will happen. The good news is, gee, maybe we'll have a continuing resolution. The bad news is, a continuing resolution still costs money beyond typical operations.
I talked to your former colleague, John Koskinen, when we were in this situation in 2011, and we looked like we might really get down to it. And he said essentially the same thing that Doug Holtz-Aiken said that you referred to in this story, that what gets lost in this is not the shutdown part, but it's the startup part of it. You don't just come back and turn the lights back on and say, okay, well, everything's fine.
Yeah.
That there's a ramp-up process that is a lot more complicated than people know.
Yes.
That process will start, though, only when it's okay to come back, too. That's not something that you can start planning. You can plan for it now, but you obviously can't start executing it until Congress has a deal in place. So that makes that even more complicated, doesn't it?
But they've already started the shutdown stuff in terms of the guidance, and agencies have to prepare plans and start notifying people today. And it's just like, this is already a disruption simply because of the uncertainty.
Ashton Carter had a news conference today to talk about what the Pentagon's going to do, Molly. And the thing there that jumped out at me the most is a small detail, but what I noticed was he mentioned that everybody that's on travel for the Pentagon, probably more than just a few people, has to come home. And I don't recall that he specified uniform or civilian. Now, obviously, if you're deployed somewhere, you're going to stay on deployment, and he was very clear about that. But if you're on travel, that ends September 30th when the shutdown begins. That just the logistics and complexity of that seem to be incredibly daunting.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's what John and I are both saying, that even if the shutdown doesn't occur, okay, there's still all these costs in the planning, and is someone looking at buying the tickets to back, and what the cost is going to be, and what if we can't get them back, and we know the government's going to spend X amount of money to bring the person back, and they're going to be at the highest rates that we can because they're going to be last minute. Mm-hmm. And so we're incurring costs already just by thinking and trying to do the planning around this. So, you know, and how those decisions are ultimately made versus what is being said today, you know, we don't know.
Well, and what I thought was interesting is, in the OMB guidance about this to agencies, one of the questions was, Well, what if it was less costly to continue operations than it would be to shut down and come back? And the answer was, it's not a cost issue. You must shut down because that's the law.
That's pretty amazing. Molly O'Neill's second most important federal news story of the week is headlined, What is the Cost of Government Shutdown? It's Josh Hicks's story in the Washington Post, and you can read it linked up now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. That's not it, though, for a shutdown conversation on this week's Federal News Countdown. More when we come back with the most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by John Kaminsky and Molly O'Neill on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, federalnewsradio.com.
Voicemail, email, conferencing, IM. More communication doesn't mean better communication. And if you're in federal IT, every missed connection is blamed on you. CDWG can help. We'll build you a seamless UC solution that meets the needs of your agency. Telephony solutions that lower costs, a single inbox accessible from anywhere means the message gets through. Conferencing and collaboration tools so everyone's on the same page. We'll deliver it all in a single solution. So you can cancel that order of why you're out notepads. Find out more at cdwg.com/unified. CDWG. People who get it.
Visit cdwg.com to learn how ShoreTel Comprehensive UC Solutions can help increase your organization's collaborative capabilities.
Meet the 2013 Causey Award winners, five feds who have broken down barriers to better the federal workforce. These human capital professionals have made a difference across the federal government, from developing initiatives beneficial to minorities and veterans, to increased training for acquisition professionals, improving labor-management relationships, and helping employees wade through sequestration. View our videos with each of the winners and read their exclusive Q&As. Find it at federalnewsradio.com. Search Causey Award winners.
Now for your Federal News Radio DoD report, brought to you by BAE Systems, afternoons at 40 minutes past the hour. The Army will pause on Sunday to recognize Gold Star mothers and other survivors of service members killed as a result of war. Events are planned at Arlington National Cemetery, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, the Tomb of the Unknowns, as well as at various installations across the country. Since 1936, Gold Star Mother's Day has been observed on the final Sunday in September. You get your DoD report brought to you by BAE Systems, afternoons at 40 minutes past the hour, on 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Molly O'Neill and John Kaminsky, and we are up to the top of the chart.
Number one.
John Kaminsky, your most important federal news story of the week plays right off Molly O'Neill's number two, and that is from USA Today through the Federal Times. Majority of federal workers exempt from shutdown. And I don't know if Mr. Cord or Cordy, I don't know how to pronounce his name, knows, but he has become the definitive number provider on shutdown, because I must have had a half a dozen people who have contacted me from outside the Beltway, media outlets or whatever, saying, is that 59% number that I'm seeing the right number, the amount of federal employees that will still go to work on Tuesday, even if a shutdown happens? What's your thought about that based on your experience from studying the government, knowing it from the inside?
What I thought was interesting is that what he did is he looked at the actual contingency plans that agencies are required to submit to OMB, and OMB is posting them on a website. So you can go in, and he's gone through, they have 119 shutdown plans that have been posted on the website so far. More will probably come. And he calculated his numbers based on that look. But you have to also remember that a lot of this, I think, doesn't include the Defense Department.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the civilian side of the government, not defense. This morning I heard that about 1 million people will be placed on furlough if the government were to go onto, you know, not pass the budget.
Yes. If appropriations lapse, yeah, is the term that they're,
yeah,
using.
But the other term is that people are either accepted or not accepted. And this is a statutory thing, And the OMB language says that the non-furloughed employees are in five categories: those that are necessary to protect life and property, those that are necessary to perform activities expressly authorized by law. The third is those that are necessary to perform activities that are implied by law. The fourth is those that are necessary to carry out the president's constitutional duties. And then finally, those agencies that have funding from other sources other than appropriation. So that gives agencies a lot of latitude to be able to basically ensure there's not huge disruptions to the general public, and that there will be weather reports, that planes will fly because the air traffic control and the TSA are there, et cetera.
All of this, though, means, Molly, that some of the folks who think that a government shutdown might not have that much of an impact on people could be, to some degree, right if people don't notice because they go to the airport and the TSA screeners are still there and they, you know, they continue to get payments on time, Social Security payments and realize Medicare benefits and all of those. You go to a VA hospital, it's still open because, as John said, that's not an appropriation in the same way. That money is appropriated differently. So there will be fewer opportunities than I think maybe people realize for them to see the impact of this face-to-face.
Yeah, I think from a general public perspective, and, you know, I always tell people we live in Washington, D.C. We live in our own little bubble sometimes. Mm-hmm. And in this case, you're very right. We'll see a huge impact. And then federal agencies that have, you know, regional offices or field offices or things that aren't doing what you say, whether they're handing out benefits or whatnot, those may see an impact. But it's going to be not the whole country, mm-hmm. right? At least it won't be as visual. Now, we'll read about it. It'll make national news. You know, we'll hear stories, and there'll be sort of political slants to how many people are really off, and it'll be, you know, pieces of different areas. But I think you're right, Francis. I think there may be parts of the country that aren't going to see an impact, and so do they care?
And it might be like sequestration, yeah. John, where they don't see it right away, where right. it takes time mm-hmm. for it to really sink, or to, you know, to trickle yeah. down to the level that
most
people interface with.
Well, I worked for John Koskinen during the shutdown in the mid-90s, and I was in those days, it was called essential and non-essential. I was deemed essential.
Well, the yeah. secret is they still call it that, just not officially.
Yeah. But what happened was that it would take a few weeks before certain things were even noticeable. For example, suddenly people found out they could go to their bank and they couldn't get a home loan. They couldn't get a mortgage because FAA wasn't there to do the paperwork. Mm-hmm. Or contractors that were doing business for the government couldn't get paid because the stuff has to be audited before the payment can be made. So it took about 2 to 3 weeks for it to have a broad impact across the economy. But, you know that's going to happen. I mean, at the time, nobody knew what would happen because that had never happened for mm-hmm. that long. And now we know.
Well, the difference, too, that I think we might see is, as far as overall economic impact, there are so many other factors that maybe weren't even factors when you experienced this, John, just because of the amount of information that people can obtain on very short order. Yeah. In 1995-96, the internet was not a big deal. This USA Today story that we're talking about mentions one key difference from the last government shutdown in 1996, agencies were less reliant on the web, referring to the fact mm-hmm. that although maintaining agency websites might be deemed non-essential, for the IRS it might be, because that's a yeah. vehicle for people to yeah. pay their taxes, and it's certainly important for that money to keep coming in. So that by itself means that people can get news and information on a 24-hour cycle that we're all very familiar with. That wasn't the case even back then. And just that may have a tremendous amount of impact on the way people perceive this and their ability to know what's going on and know where they can look for the impact in their own lives. Is that a possibility?
That's a possibility.
Think?
Yeah.
I do think it's, to chime in here a little bit on this website thing. I think that's going to be interesting because we really haven't had a shutdown with so much, right, mm-hmm. as Francis was saying. And then if you look at some of the Q&A, there's a whole section of the guidance on IT services, right? And I liked sort of trying to parse some of this because it talks about if the website really is about, right, an essential thing. But even if it's not, you should put something in there to sort of close down. But if they're so, but if those websites are so intermingled within mm-hmm. the agency, and you can't decouple or shut something off, then you can't. So this is a huge web of complexity, perhaps, in answering this question.
And as you well know, there are certainly ways that people will be able to get around those, the way things look. And I don't mean in a nefarious way. I don't mean to, like, hack into the websites or anything. But there are ways to find information that's posted on the web that is that aren't immediately obvious, that don't just involve going to the homepage and clicking. You can still find stuff if it's still there, unless it's just been taken down. And so I'm not... If you really wanted to do a full shutdown, then you're talking about taking down stuff. I mean, it starts to really get into a hair-splitting exercise, it seems.
And what I thought was interesting was that OMB's guidance and the preparation of contingency plans is something that sort of grew out of the experience from back in the mid-90s. And I think that, ironically, it seems to be going much smoother.
As we continue to look at this, we have tons of resources about what could happen at federalnewsradio.com, obviously. And we have the very latest information all weekend long posted there as well. John Kaminsky's most important federal news story of the week is the story from USA Today through the Federal Times, majority of federal workers exempt from shutdown. And you can read it and all of our Federal News Countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Molly O'Neill. Wraps up this week's Federal News Countdown next on In Depth with Francis Rose.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m., right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Concerned about your health? Then be sure to catch the groundbreaking radio show, Essentials of Healthy Living, brought to you by Village Green Apothecary in Bethesda. Join hosts Dana Lake and Kevin Passero as they bring you the latest news about traditional and alternative medicine, dietary supplements, nutrition, and healthy living. Tune in every Sunday at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Visit myvillagegreen.com, listen to past shows, and discover other healthy living resources.
Essentials of Healthy Living is sponsored by Enzymatic Therapy and Nordic Naturals.
Here's Paul Tibbetts, Deputy Chief Information Officer for Architecture, Strategy, and Design at the Department of Veterans Affairs, speaking on the panel discussion, The Path from Legacy Systems, sponsored by Ironbow and Dell.
There's application dependency issues that you have to work with. So far, we're tracking or have analyzed around 350 applications. About 50 of those still look like they may have some dependency on XP in some way, shape, or form, or lack of compatibility with Windows 7 one way or the other.
To listen to the whole program, log on to federalnewsradio.com, search term legacy.
Federal initiatives are mandating the adoption of new technology. Legacy platforms are being retired. Older applications need updating or replacement. You need solutions. Dell Software and Iron Bow Technologies work together to help you assess your options and modernize your IT, meeting your mission while reducing costs and better serving your users and constituencies. For information on migration, consolidation, and effective management of physical, virtual, and cloud environments, visit software.dell.com.
Would you trust someone with disabilities to test high-tech protective combat gear? Our armed forces do. Source America provides the military with a highly trained, exceptional workforce, people with significant disabilities. In fact, Source America provides vital expertise to thousands of federal customers across the country. For everything from contract closeouts to food service to call center support. Learn more at sourceamerica.org. An Ability One authorized enterprise.
Calling all government, military, and defense industry executives, the Association of the United States Army invites you to its 59th annual meeting and expo.
October 21st through the 23rd at the D.C. Convention Center, AUSA's annual meeting is one of the largest land warfare forums in the world.
Companies will gather to display the latest defense technology, and forums will be held for soldiers, family, government defense civilians, and industry executives.
Admission is free, limited to qualified persons. For details, visit AUSAannualmeeting.org.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week has the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by this week. John Kamensky, the IBM Center for the Business of Government, Molly O'Neill from CGI Federal. And Molly, your most important story of the week is from the Federal Times. The headline is Background Checks Under Scrutiny After Navy Yard Shooting. I guess nobody's surprised by this, even by the speed of it. But at some point, you have to dig deeper than the clearance process itself, it seems to me, because Mr. Alexis got onto the base the way he was supposed to. He had the credential he was supposed to have. So the problem wasn't on the base. The problem was in the back office somewhere.
Yeah, and, you know, I think I've read a lot of these stories for the last 10 days or so, and I'm sure you all have too. And, you know, a lot of the stories are, you know, what didn't work in the background check, what was wrong. And in this one, we talk a little bit about the self-reporting. And, well, he didn't tell us all this stuff. Well, isn't that the point of the background check, right? It's to ask, but if they don't, to go check, right? So there's a lot of on that. But it kind of also makes me think, so as I'm reading these articles, so what's missing, right? And part of me says, okay, you got a security clearance, right, for probably some of them last about 5 years, right, depending on what level you have. And if you, things, people can go astray, you know, in a five-year process. And, you know, when you hear someone who perhaps is hearing voices or something, what's wrong with, as you say, the system for the once you get the clearance?
Mm-hmm.
So we can have the discussion on what needs to be fixed in terms of the clearance process. But what this article made me think about was, okay, well, maybe he didn't self-report this stuff, and sure, we've got holes in the fact that maybe some of the state stuff didn't get into the background check, but yet we still approved it for whatever reason, we meaning the collective federal government, right? But then, even if, let's say he was clear, are we having circumstances that the behavior changed even after the fact, and how do we get that resolved? Because it seems like there's some triggers we've seen over and over and over while people are getting clearances, but maybe they, in some cases, things wouldn't have triggered, but how do you monitor behavior legally,
mm-hmm.
right, to figure out during that 5 years, are there things that we may have missed or that might trigger, you know, questionable acts?
I think that's the key thing, what Molly just said about being able to monitor and pay attention to what somebody's doing legally and ethically is also an issue because a friend of mine said, well, if this guy was hearing voices and saying all that, at some point he must have said something around somebody. Why didn't they report it? Well, how many times have we seen in government where somebody says something about a colleague and it's not true? And it doesn't happen a lot, but it does happen. And so you get into a very subjective process at a time when there's been a lot of pressure from Congress to get these things approved, get these things approved, get these things approved. The volume continues to increase, and the pressure is on to have these things done. And now we're seeing, it appears, that this is, if you can have it fast or you can have it thorough, but you can't maybe necessarily have both.
Well, there was an interesting op-ed a couple weeks ago by John Hamry, the former defense deputy secretary, who said that the design of the existing background process goes back to the Cold War, and it's no longer appropriate. And so we need to not just change the 127-page form that's talked about in the article, but change how we go about doing it overall. There's now the Internet. There's now the ability to do electronic checks of what people are doing. But I think that there's a distinction between the background checks and ongoing supervision. Because that's what actually happens is supervisors and employees, your colleagues, need to be aware of what's going on. And you can't just rely on some once every 5 year check by somebody from outside your organization and think that that's going to improve safety or security.
But where's the balance? Where is the line of demarcation between me being aware of things that might be going on in someone's life and being concerned about that person and me being nosy and telling on that person in a case where it's not necessarily appropriate or necessary? That's where I see the potential problem here, that line is not going to be the same in every case, and it's not going to be easy to discern in every case.
Well, and I think that's why this is a challenge, because – you know, John and I were talking again before the show, and we said, listen, there have been a lot of background checks done that have been, from our perspective, probably good, right? Because we haven't heard anything in the news, right? So if you take just a handful of cases, it may seem like the process is broken. But maybe it is, right? But then how do you balance that with, you know, if you're looking at in today's world where most companies are looking at insider threats, right? Not just to see are you going to look at what if someone's stealing information, government information, or even corporate secrets, right, if you're an industry. But then how are they going to use that if they're going to use it for bad purpose? But also, how are they feeling is there a threat to just the workplace, right? And that's the case in this particular instance. And so how do you, as you say, balance what we need to do to check to make sure the process is for today, but also how do we check to make sure that we haven't overstated our boundaries, but also really understand what the insider threats, insider meaning insider to the government, insider to private industry really are. And that's that balance. So this is a very, very difficult thing to address.
John, we just have a minute or so left, but I think Molly gets to a really good point, and that is we can think that the process is broken, and we can assume that the process is broken, but she makes a good point. This is one incident out of one person out of however many background checks are done. And so, it's literally a one in a million case. And I wonder if maybe our expectations are too great that we expect this process to be perfect, even though the result of the one that did go awry was so terrible.
Yeah. Well,
is that reasonable for us to want perfection in a case like this?
There are certain areas that you want perfection. You want airplanes to land every day. You don't want to have, you know, say, well, we're going to have a 3% error rate or something like that. And this is not an unreasonable thing to say, that this should have a very low error rate of a workplace safety in the federal government.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Molly O'Neill. It's from the Federal Times. Background checks under scrutiny after Navy Yard shootings. All these stories linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Thank you, John Kaminsky. Great
Thank
to have you,
you
back. And Molly O'Neill, same thing. Loved having you on the program. Remember, the Federal News Countdown moves to 4 o'clock next Friday afternoon on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.